Tomorrow, March 20th. This is the first hour of a two-hour special from Flashpoints. Stay with us. We have another hour. We're going to go back to Port-au-Prince. On this second hour of this special edition of Flashpoints, we report on the ongoing killing of Lavalas activists by U.S.-supported Haitian death squads. We'll look at the legal action being contemplated against the U.S. coups for their kidnapping of a sitting president. We'll hear a reminiscence from a young journalist who worked closely with President Aristide and the street children in Port-au-Prince. And we'll hear from an angry Bay Area Haitian who wants the U.S. held accountable for an illegal coup. We'll have the night report, of course, and of course, you're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, KPFT in Houston, and affiliates along the line. Stay with us. And you're listening to Hour 2 of this special edition of Flashpoints. We now go to New York City for the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, insurgent leader and self-proclaimed police chief Guy Philippe today promised to try to disarm his forces in Port-au-Prince. The unfulfilled pledge was punctuated by gunfire today amid traffic in front of the presidential palace and in the seaside slum of La Saline, where residents resisted an armed sweep by Philippe's militia. After a meeting with U.S. Ambassador James Foley, Philippe promised, without hint of irony, that, quoting, "As we have no intention of taking power with weapons, we thought it would be best for the Haitian people to lay down our arms," end quote. But one of his lieutenants hastened to add that, quote, "Laying down arms does not mean handing them over," end quote. As for Philippe's political and military ambitions, Secretary of State General Colin Powell today chastised the man whose triumph he had earlier enabled, telling the House Appropriations Committee, quote, "We are also in touch with some of the rebel leaders today who were proclaiming themselves into various offices that will not sustain over time," end quote. Yesterday, Philippe had ambitiously declared that, quote, "the country is in my hands," quote, and that he would now arrest the nation's prime minister. That prompted U.S. Marines to intervene today as Philippe's insurgents chased former government officials fleeing for the local airport. The whereabouts of Yvonne Neptune, the prime minister, remained unclear, even amid reports that he had been evacuated by helicopter. Former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, meanwhile, has been sent to his room without telephone privileges in a spacious villa in the Central African Republic, where he is being sequestered by troops from France, the former colonizer of both the Republic and of Haiti. Aristide attorney Ara Kurzban today said authorities had taken away Aristide's telephone, his only independent means of external communication since his exile. Yesterday, Aristide claimed in broadcast interviews that he was the victim of coup, coercion, and kidnapping, charges denied by Washington and Paris. In other news of France, the French Senate today adopted legislation banning religious symbols in schools by a vote of 296-20, thereby ratifying a ban on students' Islamic headscarves, Jewish skull caps, large Christian crosses, and other religious accessories. The National Assembly adopted a similar bill last month. President George W. Bush today renewed economic sanctions against Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and other officials, accusing them, like Haiti's former president, of undermining democracy and using violence to stifle opposition. Bush renewed an executive order freezing the assets and barring Americans from engaging in business transactions or other dealings. In Iraq, a letter from al-Qaeda today denied responsibility for bombings that killed at least 271 people and wounded 400 during the Shiite Muslim festival of Ashura, blaming American troops instead, even though the message also called Shiites infidels over a disagreement over succession from the Prophet Muhammad. And Iraq's governing council, the United States appointed body, said today that it will sign an interim constitution that is a key to the United States' plans to transfer non-sovereignty to the Iraqi puppet regime. Governing Council President Mohamed Bahr Al-Ulum told a news conference that the signing, which had been scheduled for today but was postponed after those attacks in Baghdad and Karbala, would be at 3 in the afternoon Pacific time on Friday. And that's some of the news of this Wednesday, March 3rd, 2004. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I read this statement again. The voice of bloodshed calls again from the dry lands of the South, from the poor soil, a rich voice dying for freedom. What can one do when the killing fields are in motion and the killers are being cleansed of their murderous pasts, even as they are busy killing Haiti's future, slashing hope out of the heart of family Lavalas? What can one do? One can stand up, shout out, resist in any way possible, but resist. Find the place in yourself, the limit of your belief, and go with your full body. Resist. As I said many times when we were fighting to save this network from the corporate raiders, we talked a lot about free speech. And we always hear it said, you can't shout fire in a theater that's not burning. However, if the theater is in flames and the fire is a killer and you are silent, you are responsible for the dying and the suffering. The killing fields are in motion in Haiti. The U.S. government has armed the killers. France is back in bed with the U.S. and the suffering continues. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In one moment, when we get him back on the phone, we will go to Kevin Pina on the ground from Port-au-Prince, where there were at least two leaders of Lavalas, supporters of Aristide, that were killed today. And there were some serious attacks all over the country. We will get Kevin Pina on the line in 1 minute. We are also joined on the telephone by Jean Carazon. He is a host at Radio Soleil. He's the host of Family Lavalas on Radio Soleil in Brooklyn, where there is a huge Haitian community, and many members of that community are incredibly concerned about what is going on the ground now in Haiti. Jean Carazon, I know that you have been doing a lot of reporting about the situation there, and we are going to speak with you in one moment. I do believe we've got Kevin back. Kevin, thanks for joining us again on this two-hour special. We need you to update the situation again. We're hearing a lot about a lot of attacks. Tell us what happened in City Soleil today.
Well, I was interviewing the victims of some of the rampages that the former military and crop have been doing in the poor neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince, places like City Soleil, La Saline, Bel Air, Matissan. But today I was in City Soleil, and on our way back, there was an altercation at Carrefour Aviation because Guy Philippe and the former military and FRAP decided that they were going to try to enter City Soleil by force, and the population met them with resistance. Apparently, armed U.S. Marines showed up on the scene. Well, not apparently. They did show up on the scene, and they separated the two groups. Once the Marines arrived, the shooting stopped, and we actually saw them disarm several individuals. And what appeared to be the beginning of what they say is a disarmament campaign. On the other hand, I've just heard other reports again this evening of gunfire being heard again in La Saline and in Bel Air. I'm waiting for people to get back to me to find out exactly what's going on.
Now, it was reported that at least two supporters of Lavalas were killed today. Were they killed in this confrontation?
I'm not sure. I didn't see anyone who was wounded in this confrontation, but it's entirely possible because people don't, when people are wounded and they fall, they don't leave them just lying, particularly Lavalas. They take them and give the bodies protection. I'm not sure. I can't say with certainty.
Kevin, we know that you were receiving phone calls throughout the night. Could you tell us as much as you can, without endangering the lives of people who perhaps are in hiding now, about the kinds of phone calls that you were getting and what it sounded like on the other end?
Well, for the last, since Sunday, actually, Sunday night, I've been receiving calls from four neighborhoods throughout Port-au-Prince, from people that I've worked with in various capacities. See, I've worked with a lot of people on music videos here in Haiti. I've probably produced and directed and edited over probably 20 music videos. And so I get a lot of calls from folks from different places here and from Lava Lock militants who I've known through my activities, interviewing people and trying to chronicle Aristide's second presidency. And I received several calls where I could actually hear automatic gunfire in the background, screams in the background, panic and terror in the background, as former military and FROP were raging, rampaging through those neighborhoods and indiscriminately shooting at the population. And as I stated before, the thing that was ironic about this is that the international community, the international forces, so-called peacekeeping forces, had instituted a 6 p.m. curfew. But that did not seem to apply to the former military in FROP.
In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Yesterday, you did an interview with the Prime Minister, Yvonne Neptune, of Haiti, where he was essentially being held captive in his office. A number of very important things came out of that exclusive interview, which you shared with us on yesterday's Flashpoint show. Could you recount what your interview was like and what the key points of that interview with the Prime Minister are and their significance?
Well, again, the Prime Minister was obviously upset, was obviously angered by the way in which things had come down.
This is the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister of Haiti, yes, Yvonne Neptune. He had made it quite clear that he felt like he was, that he, not that he felt, but he said, I am a prisoner in my own office, and that is a fact. He also said that he had spoken with President Aristide 3 hours before he was forced out of the country. Then President Aristide said that he was being held prisoner, that at one point then the phone cut off and the Prime Minister was no longer in contact with him. The Prime Minister also said that he did not believe that the transition was constitutional, that President Aristide had been forced out of the country under duress and under fear, and that he did not consider that to be a constitutional transition. He also said that when the oldest Supreme Court justice, as the Constitution says, when a president vacates his office, whether that be forcibly or whether that be by resigning, the oldest member of the Supreme Court then assumes the office of the presidency. The Prime Minister made it clear that the international community brought Boniface Alexandre, who is the oldest member of the Supreme Court, into his office without his knowledge, did not invite him, swore him into office, and the Prime Minister did not learn about it till afterwards, and it was at that point that he was then handed the purported resignation letter by the President.
All right, hold it. We're getting a little interference. We're speaking with Kevin Pina. He's talking to us live from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where we are seeing now serious chaos and many attacks on supporters of Lava Las. We are doing special broadcasting on the situation because we know, based on history and the U.S. involvement in coups in this country and other countries, it is this time, this lawless time, where the death squads and the U.S. Trained killers have free rein to slaughter the leadership, in this case of the Lava Las leadership, supporters of Aristide. Kevin, it was close. It was a very touchy situation after you left the Prime Minister. Could you describe what happened and how essentially they used the death squads again to try and purge him from the country?
Well, what happened is that at about 1 o'clock, we did the interview at 9. We finished the interview at about 10. At about 1 o'clock, Guy Philippe, the head of the former military, the U.S.-trained Haitian military man, former chief of Cape Haitian, him along with John Tatoon, who had just arrived with his goons from Gonaive, began to agitate a crowd in front of the old military headquarters down in front of the palace. The old military headquarters had been converted into the Ministry of Women's Affairs under the Aristide administration, and then had most recently been used as a museum for the bicentennial celebrations. It was filled with beautiful artwork, celebrating Haiti's culture and heritage. They extolled the crowd to break into the building. They burned art. They tore art down from the wall. And then they claimed that they had found small coffins with the remains of small children. Radio Megastar, one of the capital radio stations, obviously participated in this. They let them make these accusations over the radio, which was exciting a lot of people, claiming that President Aristide and Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune had been involved in voodoo ceremonies where small children were sacrificed, blood was drank, those sorts of crazy things. And then they led this crowd up to the Prime Minister's residence and offices. And they were in front of the Prime Minister's residence when I called at 4 o'clock. He wasn't exactly clear what was going on. I asked him if he had security. He said there was a very small contingent of international forces, that his security force was there. He said that he wasn't aware of how large the crowd was out in front. I got off the phone with him, and about 2 minutes later, Hazel Ross Robinson called me from St. Kitts. I explained immediately what the situation was. I understand that she had gotten on the phone with several congressmen and several senators, and that she had demanded that the international forces, particularly U.S. forces, that they had demanded. She had spoken with several senators and congressmen, and that they had demanded, called the State Department and demanded that the Prime Minister be given adequate security. About 20 minutes later, a convoy of six large trucks showed up with, I'd say, about 30 U.S. Marines, heavily armed, and the crowd at that point, Guy Philippe and his folks, backed off and dispersed. But not until it managed to frighten the Prime Minister to his core, and I know that he feels as if they may have let that go on long enough to do exactly that, to frighten him. At this moment, I spoke with him earlier this afternoon. He would not tell me where he was. He was very circumspect, was not very talkative at all. And right now, I'm rather worried about Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune and would like to know exactly where he is and know that he's safe and know exactly what his disposition is and what his plans are.
All right. Kevin Pina reporting to us from Port-au-Prince, where he has been for many years on and off. Kevin Pina, we again thank you for your terrific reporting. We urge you to be careful, and we will be speaking with you again tomorrow. Please take care.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Kevin Pina from Port-au-Prince on the line with us, as I said earlier, because we had some struggle holding on to him, is Jean Carazon and also Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, let me start with you and the possibilities for legal action. You heard what Kevin said based on his interview with the Prime Minister yesterday. They pulled the Prime Minister out of his own office, carried the ceremony out in a stealth way. The Prime Minister says no way it was a legal succession because it was happening at gunpoint. Tell us about your response to this kind of information and what legal possibilities there are.
Well, the Prime Minister is correct. While President Aristide purportedly signed a resignation letter, a copy of which I have in front of me in both the English version that the U.S. distributed as well as the original Creole, while he purportedly signed it, like any other document, if you sign it under duress or force, it's not valid. So the question here, at least in many people's minds, should be, was this freely signed by President Aristide? Was this a free resignation? From everything we've heard, I mean everything, except from Vice President Cheney and Colin Powell, but everybody who's on the scene, everybody who's spoken to either the First Lady Mildred Aristide or President Aristide or Yvonne Neptune, the Prime Minister, this was a resignation at gunpoint. This was a resignation, whether literally at gunpoint with a gun to his head, or the United States, in the slightly watered-down version of the story, saying to President Aristide, look, you either sign this or we walk away and the thugs are going to come here, kill you, your family, and all of your supporters in Port-au-Prince. Sign this. So at that point, I don't consider this any longer a free resignation, a freely signed resignation, but one of coerced resignation. And just like a contract, Dennis, imagine if you go into a place to get a contract for a car and someone says, buy this car, and they stick a gun to your head, you say, yeah, I'll buy that car. So it's the same in contract law. This is not a valid resignation. So at that point, you still have President Aristide, still the current president of Haiti, until he actually were to formally resign. That's the first problem with the resignation. The second problem is the letter of resignation itself. The U.S. issued a translation of the Creole, and that states, I have it in front of me, it says, for that reason, tonight I am resigning in order to avoid a bloodbath. Listen carefully. Tonight I am resigning in order to avoid a bloodbath. For that reason, it says. Now, why would the U.S. basically mistranslate the letter unless there was something wrong with the original resignation letter? The original resignation letter, when correctly translated out of Creole, it says, this is why, and it's then conditional, if tonight that my resigning would avert a bloodbath. So it's conditional, a condition that basically the United States put in front of him and said, well, we're going to do this because it's conditional on us letting a bloodbath happen if you don't do it. So it's conditional, and the United States obviously had a reason why they changed the language in translating it. It's because the resignation letter isn't really, apart from the fact that it was forced, isn't really a resignation letter. So you come out of here really believing that what we're talking about here is not any kind of freely, voluntarily given resignation, not a resignation at all, and that Jean-Bertrand Aristide is still president of Haiti. And there's some other details we can go through as to what could happen now and what he might do from a political and legal point of view.
Well, very quickly, please run that down.
Well, the first thing is, one of the ways this gets challenged is what happens in the United Nations or in the Organization of American States. And let's look at the United Nations. Currently, the ambassador to the United Nations is appointed by President Aristide. Let's say the new government, whatever that is, appoints another ambassador. Well, then there's a fight at the United Nations over who should have the seat. President Aristide, who I consider the current government, or the rump government that got its job, really, as the product of a coup. In that case, it's up to the UN. But the UN's history since 91 and since the end of the Cold War has been not to seat people who are there as a result of a coup. And the international law on that has developed very strongly, which is to say that they do not like coups. They like democracy. So if the UN is at all honest about itself, which so far they haven't indicated they will be, but if they are, they will not seat a new government as the representative in the United Nations. So that seems to me to be one key way to challenge this. A similar kind of thing could happen in the Organization of American States. A final word on this is that in addition to all of these ways of challenging the fact that he is still president and that there's no other president, there is a body of law, a treaty called the New York Convention. The New York Convention is a treaty that prohibits international abductions, essentially, of heads of state and similar high-level officials when they're out of their state. What happened here, actually fits within that, that basically once he got on that airplane, he was on U.S. territory, essentially, a U.S. plane, U.S. chartered plane, and he was basically abducted at that point. He was abducted in Haiti, but the treaty doesn't cover that. But the abduction, the continuing abduction outside of Haiti, taking him to the Central African Republic, the violation of the treaty, that can go to the World Court, the International Court of Justice at The Hague. It very well may be that that's where it goes. It's also a crime in the United States. The U.S. has implemented that, made it a crime in the United States, and therefore people like Colin Powell, people like Vice President Cheney, anybody in on this thing, this kidnapping, this abduction, this basically taking of a president out by force, could actually be indicted in the United States for a crime.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in Washington, D.C., talking to us about the legal ramifications, possibilities, I should say, in terms of what President Aristide, still the president of Haiti, based on the fact that he was taken out at gunpoint under duress, and we are very concerned about the idea of kidnapping a sitting president. Michael, we have just 30 seconds. When does something like this rise to the level of a potential impeachable offense. If the president is involved in a kidnapping, high crimes and misdemeanors, where does this go?
You know, Dennis, this is it. This is high crimes and misdemeanors. This is a violation of that treaty. It's a criminal violation. The coup itself, of course, being sponsored against Haiti, a violation of the UN Charter, territorial and political integrity of a country, is basically inviolate. Basically, we've done it. I mean, the president has done it. The United States has done it. I mean, members of Congress are actively pursuing various pieces of legislation. I would hope that one of them is to actually begin bills of impeachment against the president and high other officials, particularly Colin Powell.
Thank you very much, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, and an old friend of the show and of those who believe in human rights and civil rights. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the great coverage, Dennis.
And you are listening to a two-hour special edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go to an interview that I did earlier today with a good friend of mine, a former journalist student, Lynn Duff, who was in Haiti. You heard a little bit of her on a previous show, but I wanted to bring her back to talk about her work in Haiti and how she's feeling now. Listen to this.
My name is Lynn Duff. In 1995, I traveled to Haiti to help start Radio T-Moon at 90.9 FM in Port-au-Prince. Reaching the whole country, Radio T-Moon was run entirely by children and was a national voice for the rights of young people, in particular for Haiti's 250,000 homeless children. During the beginning of this second coup d'etat, I received a series of phone calls from Johnny, an 18-year-old former youth reporter with the children's radio station, which was located at the Aristide Foundation for Democracy. While he told me his story, I could hear dogs barking, people shouting, and sporadic gunfire in the background. Several times he was sobbing so loudly I couldn't hear his voice. These are Johnny's words. I was living in the gutter, dressing in old clothes, and begging at the airport when Titi'd, as we call President Aristide, took office in 1990. One of the first things Titi'd did when he moved into the National Palace was invite a group of children who sleep in the streets to visit the palace and to speak out about the conditions of the street children. I heard on the radio the voice of Little Sonny, one of the street children, speaking from the National Palace about the rights of the children, and I knew that the lives of the children in Haiti would change. When Titi became president, he told the world that we street children were people. We had value, that we are human beings. Many adults didn't like this message. They said we were dirty and should be thrown out like the trash that we are. But Titi loved us, and when I met him, he kissed me and put his hand on my face and told me that he loved me. And these were not the empty words of a politician. During the first coup in 1991, the street kids were attacked, and La Famille C'est La Vie, a shelter for homeless children started by Aristide when he was a parish priest, was burned. Aristide came back from exile in October 1994, and it was a new world for the children. 3 years of horror were over. I was just a little child at that time, but with Titi'd I felt important. We went to Titi'd and told him we wanted to have a voice in democracy, to have a voice for the children, and he gave us Radio T-Moon. We were the first children's radio station in the world, run by children and promoting the human rights of all Haitians. We spoke on the air about the news, about our hopes, and our opinions. Adults all over the country heard our voice and were forced to accept the fact that we children are people too. In the past 8 years, the radio station has gone through many changes and transitions. It was criticized and vandalized, but we knew that behind mountains, there are more mountains. The radio station was moved from La Famille C'est La Vie to the Aristide Foundation for Democracy. On Sunday at the foundation, I saw gangsters and criminals in army uniforms destroy the hopes and dreams of the Haitian people. They destroyed the building, burned books, and killed many people. A new government run by these people will surely only be bad, not only for the children, but for all the people of Haiti. I do not believe that President Aristide has abandoned us to this misery. There is no electricity, so it's hard to find news about what is really happening, but I've heard he was forced to leave, and I believe that. He would never leave us willingly. Last week, Titi'd said on the radio he would die before he would give up the struggle for democracy in Haiti. Right now, it's hard to survive, and we don't know what we'll do to find food, and we're scared to go out in the street to get water. There are gangs everywhere in army clothes, looting and burning, attacking people, and robbing those who are weaker. Everyone is fearful for the present and for the future. The U.S. Marines stood by and did nothing while the library at the Aristide Foundation was burned. With my own eyes, I saw the American Marine stand and watch while rebels cut a woman and shot her. I yelled at them, "Do something," and they swung their guns around toward me and yelled, "Get back." While I hid in a field, the American Marines put their hats on the bodies of dead people and posed for pictures with them. It made me sick. The Americans scare me. I don't believe that they want anything good for the Haitian people because they support the criminals who oppose democracy. We are fearful of the old army because they are those who killed the street children of La Famille de la Vie. They killed the peasants in the north who wanted to have democracy and supported Aristide. A new government has no hope for the children of Haiti. I am scared. I think the criminals will try to kill me, too, because I'm one of Titi's boys. But I'm not just scared for myself. I'm scared for all the children of Haiti. And today, I cannot stop crying.
That's the voice of reporter, journalist, writer, activist, Lynn Duff. Lynn, we'll let you know our appreciation for you reading that. I know that what's going on now in Haiti is affecting you very deeply. I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about how you first got involved in Haiti and with Aristide and what this all means to you.
Sorry, it's kind of hard to talk about it. I was working actually with you at Flashpoints when I was approached about going to Haiti in 1995. I was 19, and for me personally, it was an incredible experience because I shared some of the same experiences as the kids I was working with there on starting the radio station. I've been homeless for a number of years myself, and what I saw in Haiti was incredible because it was a group of marginalized kids who stood up and said, "We want to have a voice," and the president actually listened to them, which I just thought was amazing. And when we first started Radio Timun, it was small, a 300-watt transmitter. It just reached Port-au-Prince and maybe some of the suburbs, Pétionville, Carrefour, but that was about it. And within a few years, it was national. And you'd drive down the streets and you'd hear people listening to Radio Timun and hear them listening to the kids that they used to think were just trash. They would call them fatra, which means trash, like garbage. And you'd hear them listening to the voice of these kids interviewing people and speaking out about their lives and giving the news, you know, just reporting on what's going on in their country. And it was so empowering in such a real way. And I've been, you know, disconnected from it for a while. You know, I've been living in Israel for off and on for the past couple of years. And just to come back and to hear this now, it's just, that is just really sad. I mean, these are my kids. You know, I feel some sense of ownership. And, you know, I'm really worried for them because I hear about how people are being killed. And these kids are totally defenseless. And for years, Aristide told them that they have to find a peaceful way to find solutions to their problems with people, that they shouldn't pick up guns, that they should talk out their problems. And the people who are trying to kill them don't care about talking out problems. They just want to kill them.
I know, Lynn, that you actually discussed these things with President Aristide, that you argued with him and worried that there's got to be a way to have a defense. Maybe you could share a little bit of that dialogue and also sort of consider as you do and respond to this that as we speak there's a massive disinformation campaign on to paint Aristide as a murderer. You know, the whole routine. Could you talk about this?
Yeah. It's just, I read the news coverage and it on the one hand it makes me laugh and then it's just so sad that, you know, you can't laugh anymore. It's ridiculous. Aristide is one of the most peaceful people I've ever met. I'm just thinking back to this one conversation. First of all, they keep painting him as this, like, wealthy dictator who kind of just ruled over these people and did necklacing and all this stuff and murdered his opponents. And that's so far removed from the Aristide that I knew. I mean, he's such a simple guy, you know. I'm just thinking back to this conversation we had. It must have been like 1999, and we were sitting in his kitchen, and, you know, they're making sandwiches and stuff, and we were talking about the whole issue of disarming the military. And I was so... I'm sorry. I'm crying.
It's all right. It's all right. It is very much on all of our minds that as we speak, the U.S. military, which armed these mass murderers again and gave them back the keys to the killing fields, are refusing to disarm them, and these killers, Haiti's future, are in the streets. So we are all troubled, and that is why we're doing this emergency programming on Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio, and we will continue to do it. Lynn, you want to tell us a little bit about that conversation with the president?
Well, he thought I was too radical, and maybe I was, but I couldn't understand why he wasn't doing more to try and disarm these people. And he was trying to explain to me that there are these larger forces. You know, there's the international community, and that the guns come from someplace, and the guns didn't come from Haiti. And I didn't understand that. I didn't understand the role that the international community played in what happened in 91 to 94, and then again, you know, obviously what just happened this past week, these past few weeks. Aristide's message was always one of reconciliation, and he said, look, there are political forces here in Haiti. They don't really like me. They don't like the message that I have. But this is a democracy. We have to talk to them. They have to also have a role. They have to be involved in the elections. They have to be given a voice as well. And democracy is painful and difficult because it's not just you talking and giving your message that you want to hear. It's also letting other people talk and give their message that they want to hear. And, Dennis, I've struggled with that so much because I don't think that these people should have had a voice. And Aristide was so firmly committed to democracy that he was willing to let his opposition have a voice and have a role in the democratic process, even when people lied about him and maligned him and basically spit on the ideals that he was promoting. And I think, you know, all of us who listen to Flashpoints and other progressive radio shows, most of us, I feel sometimes like I'm preaching to the converted, like most of us believe that there should be democracy in Haiti, and most of us don't believe some of the lies that we're hearing. But at the same time, it just scares me that I hear these other things in the mainstream media, and I know that they're not true. And
well, we were talking about this a little bit before we began. Talk a little bit about the things that you hear that are laughable, why they're laughable, and why they're dangerous.
Okay, like the necklacing thing. They keep repeating over and over again that Aristide promoted necklacing, which is it's where you take an old tire, you fill it with gasoline, you put it around somebody's neck, and you set it on fire. That is not Aristide. He would never support that. I mean, it's completely laughable. All of us who know him, who've met him, know that it's completely laughable. This man was so patient and so peaceful and so pacifist that many of us who are not so much from the pacifist model, we're frustrated with it. I mean, he would never hurt an opponent. He'd never order an opponent to be injured. It's completely, completely out of character, but they keep repeating and repeating these lies over and over again until people believe that they're true.
That's the voice of Lynn Duff, journalist, writer, student of Haiti, went to Haiti, helped found the first radio station in the world run by children, street children, some of the poorest kids in the world. We were talking the other day, Lynn, and you know that I was down there just before you when these kids, many of them who lost their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their aunts, their uncles, their grandmothers, were slaughtered by some of the same very people who are back on the streets, you know, killing the future as the administration of Bush cleansed their bloody past. I met them. They were living in the graveyard. They were living in the National Cemetery. They were being taken advantage of by the elite class there that's now back in charge. There was a thing going on in which some of these idiotic, vicious predators would think, well, if I get the kid young enough, I won't have to worry about AIDS in a country where there's an AIDS pandemic. And then there was something for them to do, and that's where projects, and it wasn't just the radio station that Aristide jumped in on. There were many things going on, weren't there, Lynn?
Oh, yeah. He started a program for RestaVex. These are the kids who are, they're the first to get up in the morning, the last to go to bed at night. They're basically child servants. You know, some as young as 4 or 5 years old. They live as domestic servants in the homes, not just of the wealthy, but also of the middle class and even the working poor. And they're just treated like crap. He had these kids to the National Palace. He had them over to his home to go swimming on a regular basis, not just as a, you know, publicity ploy or something like that, like some American politician would do. But, you know, I would go over to his house and see these kids, these groups of kids swimming in his pool and playing with his children. And Mildred would make them lunch, and they'd all hang out with him and talk to them. And I just remember this one girl was talking to him one time, and she was sitting on his lap, and she was talking about her life, and he was kind of teasing her and asking these questions, and, you know, asking who did her hair and did she like to have barrettes in her hair and stuff like that, and playing with her. And she said to him, nobody's going to believe me that I met the president. And he just laughed. He said, okay, you can come back next week, too. This is a man who really, he cared. He saw that these children are people and saw that they were human beings and told them that and told the world that. And these are kids who were like the bottom of society. And he raised them up to a position where they had a voice and they were included. And he felt that that was essential to the democratic process, even though they weren't old enough to vote, that they should be able to have a voice, that they should be able to speak out about their experiences and about their lives. And I think that's why so many people in the middle class, so many people, you know, in positions of authority and power were so opposed to Aristide, because as long as these children had a voice and were speaking out, and it wasn't just the children, it was also, you know, peasants, it was also market women. I mean, he started these programs through the Aristide Foundation for Democracy where they were doing micro-lending with market women and literacy classes. And, you know, as long as the poor had a voice, it was a real threat to the people who, you know, are the people now who want to come back into power and are grasping at power now. And what scares me is all of those people who are involved in that, those are the people who are being targeted now. All of the, you know, the individuals who were involved in maybe just teaching a literacy class, you know, he'd bring people into the foundation and they'd teach a group of maybe like 10 or 15 women how to read and write, and they'd train them how to go out and teach other women how to read and write, because Haiti has incredibly high illiteracy rate. And these people.
I'm going to interrupt right there. That's Lynn Duff talking about her work with President Aristide and the Aristide Foundation, and working with street kids, very poor kids, homeless kids, kids whose parents, brothers and sisters, and various relatives were killed by death squads. Once again, given, I guess, the keys to the Haitian killing fields by the U.S. government, who has empowered the killers to go back into the country. Joining us now is Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She was in hearings today dealing with this in Congress. Representative Waters, welcome back to this special edition of Flashpoints.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Yes, we did have a hearing today. It was a subcommittee on the Western Hemisphere under the International Relations Committee, and we had the infamous Mr. Roger Noriega, the Assistant Secretary of Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs for the U.S. Department of State, along with some other people on two panels.
Tell us what you learned. What are the key questions that these people need to answer, and did they answer them?
Well, first of all, Mr. Noriega did not answer the questions very well. He was asked a lot of questions by mostly Democratic members of the committee. For the Republicans, for the most part, they were just spouting back all of the rhetoric and the disinformation that they've been fed by Mr. Noriega himself. But we asked a lot of questions about the former military guys that are back in town from the old FRAP organization, Guy Philippe, Louis Jordel Chamblain. We asked them about the fact that these killers had come back in the country from out of exile, that they threatened the president. They never were denounced by Mr. Noriega and the so-called opposition. They threatened the president, threatened to kill him. They wreaked havoc up in Gonaive and Cape Haitian. They killed police officers. They killed Lavalas people. And then after they forced the president out of the country, these guys rode into Port-au-Prince. And Guy Philippe is saying that he's now going to reorganize the old army, the military, and they've been killing Lavalas and Aristide supporters. And we asked them, didn't they know who they were? How did they get back in? We even went so far as to ask about the weapons that we understood they had, F-16s that were American weapons. How did they get them? We asked why could they not have sent in international forces to shore up the Haitian army, Haitian police force, and to avoid what is taking place in Haiti right now. We asked all kinds of questions, and he did not answer them very well. He avoided them. He tried to ignore some of them. He even told one congresswoman, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who asked a question, that it was none of her business.
It was none of her business. It wasn't the people's business, huh?
That's right.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Representative Maxine Waters. There were hearings today in Congress about what many feel was a sort of the culmination of a multi-year destabilization program against Haiti. Representative Waters, we had you on the air a few days before Aristide says he was kidnapped.
Yes.
At that time, you were with us. You were concerned about the ongoing destabilization program. You were concerned about how the opposition wasn't really representative of the people of Haiti, that you were concerned that there was going to be a bloodbath, appears to be taking place now. Do you still... Then, of course... It was the kidnapping, it does appear, the kidnapping or the forcing out of office of a duly elected sitting president. Do you still feel, is it your belief that this was a coup, the culmination of that destabilization situation? And what do you plan to do to try and get to the bottom of this beyond today's hearings?
Yes, I want you to know that I do believe that it was a coup, that he did not leave willingly, that he was forced out. It was just every day that I talked with him for the past 2 weeks, he had said over and over again that he would never leave, that he was not going to, continue to have Haiti the kind of place where you change governments by coups, that he had been democratically elected, and he wanted to serve out his 2 years. This is very dramatic, what has happened. And it has great implications for all of the Caribbean and particularly small countries. If we allow our country to do this kind of regime change, to be involved in these kind of coup d'etats, to be involved with a running democratically elected president out of office, then a lot of those countries, particularly in the Caribbean, should be very, very concerned. We think they have in their sights not only Aristide, but Chavez over in Venezuela and Fidel Castro to move on next. And so we are calling for investigations. And I know that much of what we have to do is going to require the kind of digging that goes beyond just sending somebody out there to find out, what happened at the point that the president was removed. You've got to understand the history of this country and what it means to have rebels who were part of the paramilitary and who were connected to Constant, the old FRAP officer, and the people that they killed and the mayhem that they were involved in, to go after this in ways that you can try and connect the dots and have people to understand how massive this is. So we're going to not only call for the investigation, we're going to work very hard at trying to set up opportunities to educate the public about who the opposition is, who the so-called rebels are, about who's making money on Haiti, about the sweatshops down there, about the bourgeoisie business mulatto class, and how the squeeze was put on this president with no bilateral support from the United States, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, how they treated him, how they left, and what is needed there. So we're going to spend a lot of time on Haiti. We're not going to let the issue die so that we can try and influence what happens in the for the future of Haiti.
Now, finally, Representative Waters, we have been speaking with dozens of Haitians on the air, off the air. They're troubled. Many are in hiding in Haiti now who worked with President Aristide. Many are saying that more has to be done. Many are saying, how come we don't see people, the Congress, people who really believe in what we were trying to do with President Aristide? How, are they going to commit civil disobedience? Are they going to... is there going to be a mass action by Congress, by any members of Congress, to get arrested, to stand against a coup? Is there going to be an investigation for potential articles of impeachment? Does this rise to the level of impeachment? A lot of frustrated, furious, frightened voices wondering what's going to happen next.
Well, one of the things that we're doing is, the first thing was to get the president's message out. When the president called, he said he wanted the world to know. And so the minute we got it and we went up on air, and we broke this story, we've been getting hundreds of calls that we've been trying to field all day long and in between the committees. At the same time, we're trying to, do our committee work so that we can open this up to investigation and to help teach the other members here what is going on. And so we will be developing an ongoing plan of action to deal with this issue. We do know that people's lives are in danger, and we do understand that they want to make sure that we are helping. So that's one important thing about doing these radio broadcasts, is that we can keep them up to date on what's going on and what we're doing. We're going to continue to do that, and we will have a strategic plan that hopefully will include making face-to-face contact through an official visit to where President Aristide is, making sure that we oversee the humanitarian assistance so that people are not hungry, making sure that we get those thugs out of town who are wreaking havoc on the Haitian people, making sure that we stabilize the situation in ways that, people are not mistreated, and then paying attention to the organizing of the new government and making sure that the Haitian people are deciding what is going on rather than just the United States trying to install a puppet. So all aspects of this are being worked on at this time.
All right. Representative Maxine Waters, we thank you for your vigilance on this subject. We know that you were back and forth in the weeks leading up to this forcing a sitting president out of a country. You've been on this for years. I know that, and we thank you for spending this time with us today.
Well, you're so welcome.
All right.
Thank
you're listening.
You.
Thank you very much. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're now joined by John Carazon. We've been holding him for quite a while. He is a terrific journalist. He works with Radio Soleil in Brooklyn. He does the program, Family Lava Loss. John, thanks for being so patient. One of the reasons we wanted you with us is to continue to bolster, the reality about what Aristide has been doing for Haiti, because we're, needing to counteract this massive disinformation campaign meant to demonize him. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you've been looking into and how you can talk to that?
Well, I would like to start by giving a heartfelt, taking my hats off to Representative Maxine Waters. I mean, the people of Haiti have never been so well represented here in the United States. And the work that she's doing, the work that Barbara Lee is doing, the work that Conyers and all the other members of the Black Caucus, it's really, really, I mean, this is where I get my energy, the courage to keep on pushing for the Haitian people to have their rights respected. So a million thanks to those folks, and only God can give them back what they are doing for the people of Haiti right now. And a lot of my brothers and sisters, as you know, in Haiti are dying every minute. And right now, the members of the cabinet members of President Aristide are in hiding. And they had to move today from where they were to another location, because it seems like those terrorists have found out where they were hiding. So it's not an easy situation for the people on the ground. The prime minister is basically under arrest, and no one knows what's going to happen next. And it is very, very scary. Now, to those who think that the Lavalas government didn't do anything, you know, there has not been one single government or one single administration who did more for Haiti, in Haiti, than Lavalas in the past 10 years. You know, the amazing thing is that the other president that did a lot for Haiti was Antoine Simon. That was in the beginning of the century. And this guy didn't even know how to read. There are certain things that people just say things, but they cannot prove what they are saying. You know, and if it wasn't in two occasions, the power of the people was stolen by the United States and given to the thugs, to the criminals, to the terrorists. It happened in 1991, and it happened again last weekend. If you look at Haiti right now, a lot of the things that were built at the expense, the hard work of the people of Haiti, the little money that the Lavalas regime, that President Aristide administration had, and these things, they are just destroying them. If you look at the parks that were built in Haiti, 56 or 57 of them, right now, they have absolutely no regard for what was done. They are basically destroying the country. Philip said that he would not take order from the Marines. That's what he said. He appointed himself chief of the army and said that he would not take order from the Marines. It's CNN reported that. It's not like they don't know. But what has been done?
We only have a few seconds.
Nothing. Okay. And, you know, 163 high schools. That is from 32 high schools. It's 32 high schools to 195 today. The President Aristide, the Lavalas regime, built 163 high schools, 4 hospitals in the metropolitan area, 1 in Delma 75, 1 in Delma 33rd, Delma 33. There is one by the cathedral. It was just a little clinic. Right now, it's a mini hospital. And
we have to interrupt now. John Karazin, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
We thank you. We're going to bring you back again and keep talking about this.
Okay, no problem.
You take care, John Karazin.
All right. And would you please, there's something that I'd like to talk to you about. If you could hold me on the line for a second.
Okay. We'll come back to you.
Okay.
That does wrap it up for the show. We're sorry, John Karazin. We did 2 hours, and we're going to be back with more. And that does wrap it up, though, for today and for Flashpoints, which airs every weekday. and is produced by myself, Dennis Bernstein, with senior producer Nora Bowers, Friedman, associate producer Solange Echevarria, roving producer Miguel Molina, contributing producer Robert Knight, technical director Miguel Guerrero. Check us out on the web, www.flashpoints.net. You could write to me at dbernstein@igc.org. We thank our web team, Kevin Purcell, Brad Smith, and we thank you for listening. Free the people of Haiti.
Redemption songs. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds.
You're listening to KPFA or KPAB in Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno.